Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey guys, you ever wonder what Phil and I wear while we podcast? You can find out if you join our Patreon. We'll also be talking about the films of 1989, but that's definitely less important than seeing our Zoom backgrounds, our headphone choices, and our sweatshirts.
It's true. It's true. You'll get to see all the various pieces of artwork that I have framed on my office wall, and you can see Kenny's garden, sort of. So that's something. That's exciting.
It's a hanging garden.
It's a hanging garden. But perhaps more important than anything, we are doing this Patreon to cover the best films of 1989. Batman, When Harry Met Sally, Indiana Jones, The Last Crusade, Ghostbusters 2, with amazing guests like Tom Meissen, Liz Hanna, Joanna Robinson, Brian Cogman, Chuck Hayward. You can sign up at patreon.com/podcastlikeit's1989. And for $5, you'll get access to all the audio of these fantastic episodes. For a few bucks more, you'll get video as well of our 99 and 89 episodes. And perhaps, most importantly, you'll be supporting us so we can just keep making podcast content for you guys.
Hello and welcome to Podcast Like It's 1999, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1999, playing poker for human scalps here in 2021. Wow. I'm one of your hosts, Kenny Nybart.
And I'm Felisco.
And with us today from the great This Had Oscar Buzz podcast is Chris Feel. I did ask you. It is Feel, right?
It's File.
What a shithead.
That's okay.
Not you,
because
me.
I can run. I've run with this my whole life. It's fine.
It also to defend Kenny, I feel like whatever someone assumes is the right pronunciation most times feels like it's wrong, right? Like the go-to is always...
Yeah. As a fellow Germanic name haver, I get Nybart all the time, and I'm Nybart.
I get Ice Cove all the time.
Yeah, well, Ice Cove just sounds great. That's just a good sounding name.
Well, that's not my name. But sure.
I know, it's unfortunate. I have a friend, your name, your spelling, Chris Feel.
Wow.
Yeah, the exact same spelling. So... We got together,
we convened and said there can be only one.
Yes.
And this is how we worked it out.
That's right. And I think File's a far superior pronunciation as a German eye haver as well.
No matter how you pronounce it, it opens itself to all different type of schoolyard people making
this
fun of
true.
You.
Sure. Yes.
Yep.
Yeah. You know, that's...
What are you gonna
That's the trouble with having a name, you know.
Kids are assholes.
Yes, kids are pieces of shit.
I'm hereby only going by the artist formerly known as Chris File.
Yes.
Perfect.
Yes. Yep. So, Chris, you're on to do mm-hmm. Ang Lee's Ride with the Devil, a film that's come up here and there on our podcast. Mm-hmm. You know, in the beginning of this journey 4 years ago or so, we definitely highlighted how so many of our premier directors had a film here, and so many of them this year, I mean, and so many of them were not, you know, among their best or yeah. most well regarded films. This is probably Ang Lee's biggest whiff, at least critically. I don't mean in terms of how the way I feel about it, but
if it wasn't in the Criterion Collection, it would yeah. absolutely yes. be like his yeah. least regarded, like the least yep. remembered, mentioned, and like it makes total sense because like he as an artist like has these huge swings that are either hits or entire mm-hmm. misses, and this is an entire miss, and it's like yeah. it's fascinating for so many different reasons.
It's also interesting too because, you know, we'll talk about sort of like Aang's career, but I do think that it falls at an interesting time too because, you know, he's coming off of Sense and Sensibility and The Ice Storm. He has this film, and then quickly, you know, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon comes right after it. But the later flops are a more expensive flops. I mean, you know, Gemini Man and Billy Lynn are very expensive technological swings. And he hasn't had a hit in a while. Like, he hasn't had something that's really connected in a while.
He's also he also has two Oscars now.
Yes, correct.
One of them, you know, one of them is for a movie that he kind of got it because of the technical wizardry of it.
Correct.
So,
Ben Affleck wasn't nominated?
Whatever. Listen.
Don't get me on my high horse about talking about how underrated Lincoln is. Don't make me do it.
Oh, that's interesting. I love Lincoln. Lincoln's great.
I mean, not underrated. People like that movie, but sure, like at the time, people were such snobs to that.
It was a weird moment for the Oscars. Mm-hmm. The entire last decade, the teens were a total fucking nightmare. But the thing with Ang Lee and Life of Pi, as far as I can tell, is what he got after that was the ability to try a lot of fucking shit. You know, he's trying some weird ass shit with Gemini Man and with Billy Lynn. And I think he can kind of just do that forever now. I do think he has almost this James Cameron-ish, like, you have certainly delivered for us many times over. What he did with Brokeback, after Brokeback, I mean, is kind of the place where I'm like, what were you doing and what were you thinking and where were you going and what were you, like, that's the one that's when you really try some narrative and thematic shit that I feel like he pulled back big time.
Yeah, his career, to your point, Kenny, I agree with you, post-Brokeback is a little bit flummoxing just because you're sort of like Lust, Caution, Taking Woodstock are two films that, for all intents and purposes, don't really exist. I mean, and I don't say that, you know, derisively in terms of Lust, Caution. I know there are people that quite like that film. And I think
love
it's
that movie.
I don't mean to suggest
podcast,
that it's a bad
movie.
We
did
movie.
An episode of it. Yeah. I fucking love that movie.
And by the way, I didn't mean that in a shitty way. I just mean that's a swing at coming off of, you know, we're going to do our top five Ang Lee films at the end of this podcast, and we'll talk about sort of what I would argue are probably about four stone cold masterpieces, and then like other films that kind of fall into his category, into his filmography, that are fascinating. And I think Lust, Caution is one of them. Taking Woodstock's more of a head scratcher because you're just sort of like, why? Like, why did we do this movie? Like,
One of the weirdest, slams at the end of a trailer of all time from Ang Lee, the goofy Dimitri Martin movie, which by the way I like, but
it's not a bad movie.
Yeah, no, I do. I like it.
I don't think a lot of it like works, and it's just like it's. I mean, in terms of like that's probably the hardest one to pin to another one of his movies, because like it's really easy to kind of like see some dualities in some of his work, and like maybe in terms of how they were received, it's on par with Ride with the Devil in terms of like it wasn't like it was reviled, but like it died immediately. Gone. But like Taking Woodstock had better distribution than this movie did, which like this is from USA Films, which like was one of the precursors to like Focus Features, which does a lot of Ang Lee's movies now. And like James Shamus wrote this movie. It was also the partnership with Good Machine. It's this weird transitional time that like we've talked about on my podcast before, where it's like the indie distributors for like these major studios. This is underneath Universal. Like this is, they're trying, Universal's trying to figure it out, right? And it's like they have this movie, which is incredibly like expensive for what it is. And like it's maybe not his biggest bomb because it's not his biggest budget, but like in terms of the scale of the bomb and how much money this movie made relative to what it cost,
that's the biggest. I mean, to your point, I don't have like the numbers to compare it to his others, but I'll just say like a $38 million budget that makes back $635,000
20 years ago
is rough. That's a rough flop.
I think there are a couple of things here. One, because I think it's interesting what you're saying about the those corporate studio attempts to build these indie studios under them, and the oxymoronic nature of that has always been kind of interesting to me, because indie stopped being obviously about independent cinema. Like that's it literally makes no sense. It was some kind of weird catch-all term for quality, and elevated quality to some extent, but quality. And all of a sudden, you know, 4 years after the that indie run at the Oscars in 95, one of which was The English Patient, which kind of falls into this, somehow a Civil War epic becomes an indie movie, right? Yeah. Like somehow that's that is now also an indie movie with major stars.
$40 million to
$40 million?
And is all like the appeal of the movie is the historical accuracy and like... sending them off to like training so that they can like truly enact like how to do these like shitty old guns.
And
it does make me think about Cold Mountain though, which comes out a few years after this, right? And is also sort of, to your point, Kenny, baked under this pseudo independent kind of vibe with Miramax, and it being at the time the most expensive film that Miramax had ever sort of bankrolled, and this, that, and whatever. But they're different movies. But you understand what I'm saying, Kenny?
Yeah, of course. Well, by then they just kind of, you know, dropped the bullshit act and acknowledged that they were making big movies too. Right. When New Line starts making
Lord of the Rings,
you knew it was over. Right. Like at that point, they're all the same. And then you had these eventually you had these new actual indies coming up beneath them. You know, your A24s and whatnot that eventually kind of were in and now aren't anymore either. It's just that's just the nature of the business. Yeah. The other thing that, you know, we're going to talk about, but I want to bring it up now is Jewel. And
listen, when I picked this episode, I followed my heart, my intuition.
Yes.
And it led me in the right direction.
So, well,
she's good in this. I liked her in this.
She's good. I'll tell you what, she's better than her co-star.
You know, well, we will talk about him.
This is also a huge time for Jewel. Like,
we'll talk about that guy in a second.
Yeah. Wait, is this post
her second album, I think, right? So
not only is this the year after her second album, but also in 1998, she has her book of poetry.
That's a big deal. And I was going to bring that up.
God forbid we forget that Jewel has a book of poetry.
Chris, you want to say something?
I was going to say, is that book still in print?
Good question.
A Night Without Armor?
Oh, Jesus. Hold on.
Is it with a K? Oh, no, it's with
not
an N.
Not with a K.
It's with an N. A Knight Without Armor. It makes
and
more
a lot
sense
of don't
that
believe
way.
It is still Jewel in print.
Shit for her not knowing how to use words. Personally, I can relate. There was this, I remember this from MTV, Kurt Loder interviewing her about it, and specifically over the word casualty, and she like shuts down because he calls her out on like not knowing the meaning of words, and she like calls him glib or something. I think that was Tom Cruise, but something like
was
that.
Probably sure, used it sure, wrong. Sure.
Shuts down.
So you're
you can still get it on Amazon right now, just for those listeners who do want to buy it. Buy a book that opens with The Bony Ribs of Adam. But yes, please continue.
It's by a great thought person of the 20th century. So I want to run through Jewel real fast. Please. Here's the thing. There's a few things with Jewel that are interesting to me. One is, you know, Jewel was a yodeler. Like an actual real life yodeler. That's how she made her money. She lived in her car. She came down from Alaska. She yodeled at high schools. I know this because she yodeled at my wife's high school before she got famous. Then, and I think it was 95, that first album comes out and it kind of hits like a rocket ship, right?
Yeah,
people really love this, and this is a period of time when artists like Jewel would come out with one album and kind of break out on the mainstream. Now, I think Jewel kind of got bigger than most of her like
counterparts, Joan Osborne's of the world.
Yeah, I mean, you like Sarah McLachlan's, like a lot of them had wound up doing theme songs for teen shows, and then and then a lot of them wound up on Lilith Fair, and I think Jewel transcended that a little bit.
I agree.
And then she puts out this poetry book, and America in mass said no, you stay in your lane, Jewel. You stay in your lane. We know how to send you back to Alaska, and we will do it. And that was so fucking mean and cruel. And then
fucking assholes then.
You're monsters.
It's not good. I remember reading the Jewel poetry book, and I cannot say I will defend her, but not in a way that I can say that it's good. But like you have to admire her for like trying these things and like still have a sustaining career. Like in the span of 2 years, she's in her first acting role in one of the world's most important directors. And it's like not some cameo role. This isn't a real thing, but like Emmy Lou Harris showing up in Cold Mountain.
Sure.
Not real.
I mean, it's the equivalent we have two Courtney Love performances in 1999, and so I would assist, you know what I mean? And who we believe is one of the sort of unsung heroes of 99 in the sense that she's an actor, a musician that became an actor, you know, and as I'm sure your podcast has talked about this, you know, Hollywood doesn't think kindly on musicians that decide they want to be actors all of a sudden.
Right? But they give the benefit of the doubt.
They do.
To crazy weirdos like Courtney Love.
Yeah.
And quote unquote, I mean, and don't get me wrong, I think Courtney Love's music is incredible and I love her. But she is outside of what I think what Hollywood would call like their mainstream. Mm-hmm. Jewel is right in the middle of it.
Yeah.
And when a Jewel or a Mariah Carey or even a Whitney Houston or a Madonna, when a lot of these people who are like in the club then go try to make a movie, they get just destroyed, which is why I think Lady Gaga in A Star Is Born is one of the greatest fucking things I've ever seen, because everybody wanted her to die in that movie. everyone wanted her to just fucking go up there and humiliate herself.
They did.
Even like the biggest haters were like, even people who didn't like that movie, who are my sworn enemies, were like, like Phil used to be before he came around. Even you were like, Lady Gaga was amazing.
She's good in it. Yeah, I mean, I think that I'll say this, though. For what it's worth, I don't think that this role for Jewel is as dynamic or as rich as you would hope, because she fucking shows up, is the thing. Like, from her first moment in the film, which is about 45 minutes into it, it's a real kick in the ass. Like, it's a moment where you're like, I need to pay attention now. Like, she commands your attention. She's charming. Totally. She's very watchable. And then, unfortunately, she disappears for large swaths of the movie. And when she surfaces, it's to breastfeed, it feels like. She just doesn't really do much in this movie, unfortunately.
She's not asked very much, but like, she's at least a more natural presence than some other
all of her counterparts in this film?
Basically, except for Jeffrey Wright.
They
dye Margot Martindale's hair red, so it's like you can't even get invested in Margot Martindale.
That was to her and Wilkinson. I was just like, why did you cast? They're so wasted. They don't do anything
for a second. Yeah.
Yeah. But like the stakes are a little bit lower for Jewel. And like you would think going into it again, that like expectation that like the stakes would be higher because of Ang Lee's stature, even at this point, you know, it's not, you know, it's pre Crouching Tiger, pre Brokeback Mountain, but like Ang Lee is still like a huge name. You would think it would be higher, but like, it's almost kind of like this weird artifact. Remember when Jewel was in an Ang Lee movie, but like, no, she, I think the low stakes kind of serve her because she can just be a very natural presence on screen.
I would also, you know, so apparently DiCaprio and Matt Damon both turned down the Tobey Maguire role.
Smart.
Which makes sense. And I come back to sort of, this is Toby at his worst, in my opinion. I there are Tobey Maguire films that I adore. I straight up love The Ice Storm. I love Wonder Boys. I love Pleasantville. But then he gets to this next rung and I don't like him there. Yeah. And I don't really want to watch him there. We did Cider House Rules, which is also 99. And seeing like these two films are perfect personifications of things I never want to see Tobey Maguire in. He's just not
reading
that
my
guy.
Mind. I, because the thing is, I too, as you know, Phil, love The Ice Storm and love Wonder Boys. Don't love Pleasantville quite as much as you do, but it has not his fault. As soon as someone decided you are not only a leading man, but like, a tough guy murdering leading man. I had to leave so fast. Nothing gets me less excited than seeing Tobey Maguire's name number one on a credit scroll.
Yeah. He's not even the top billed in this movie.
I know
Skeet Ulrich is top billed.
I know, which was the only thing that made me kind of excited.
Skeet Ulrich dies like an hour and a half into this.
What's going on here? It's earlier than that. It's like I think it's like an hour, maybe it's about an hour and a half. But I like
Skeet. You know, I mean, like, but again, like this is like some of the worst Young Guns casting odyssey I've ever seen. The guy I really do like, and you know, God rest his soul, is Jonathan Brandis. Like,
he's good. Yeah,
the second I realized that was him, it broke my heart.
Yeah.
He was good. Like, he could have kind of done that thing that very few child actors do. Clearly, I'm saying Toby was incapable of, which was, you know, kind of mature into adulthood. Yep. Mm-hmm. He was kind of there in this with this performance. So
I agree. I just think that I mean, listen, Tobey Maguire is in The Ice Storm, which is a film that Ang Lee does a few years previous. So they obviously have that relationship. But part of the problem is that I don't particularly buy Tobey Maguire in period pieces. He feels like a pretty modern person to me, for good or for bad. And I just don't buy him as a bushwhacker during the Civil War. So immediately I'm just like, you're already pushing me. And then on top of that, you have this film, and there's a bunch of critics that talked about the comparisons to like Terrence Malick, which I think is an interesting comparison, because I do think this film struggles with wanting to have this very sort of esoteric, almost poetic kind of component of the way that people speak, the way that sort of it's shot, the way it's paced is very deliberate. But at the same time, you can tell that whether or not this is a studio involvement or if this is whatever, it's also trying to be plot driven and it's trying to be a war epic. Yeah. Like it's trying to do too many things.
I don't see any comparisons to Terrence Malick here.
I don't either. I think they're being kind.
I don't get it either. The one that I got, and I see why it wasn't, you know, at the time in the critical response, you know, this is a movie that has since 1999 received like more of an outspoken like appreciation. And that's Heaven's Gate. I thought of Heaven's Gate the whole fucking time because that, first of all, like, I mean, Heaven's Gate's another like hour and a half longer than this one is, but this one feels like it's an hour and a half longer than
Heaven's
Gate.
This was a slow fucking movie.
Oh man. I apologize to you both for picking this.
No, we're going to do it eventually.
But
I mean, like, I thought of that because like, obviously like this is a huge bomb, but it's like, you know, it didn't destroy a studio the way that Heaven's Gate did. But like, just like the attention to detail, like being, you know, what's driving it rather than anything narratively, which I don't think is true of Heaven's Gate. I do really like Heaven's Gate, but in terms of like the reception, like it would have at least made sense if people made that comparison. But even like the Terrence Malick of this time, like, I don't see how you watch this movie and you think, yeah, Badlands or yeah, Days of Heaven. It doesn't make any sense.
Thin Red Line had come out the year before. And I think might have been what's on people's minds a little bit, but it's
not as good as Thin Red Line.
It's just this reductive thing of like, oh, look, a widescreen image where there's a field.
I also think that, and I might be wading into some, you know, choppy waters, but let's go ahead and do it.
Okay.
The Civil War is not a black and white, and not a gray war the way a lot of our wars have been, right? It's not a carnage for carnage's sake. It's not, you know, rich people sending poor people to die. It's not like there are good guys and bad guys in the Civil War. And it's very hard to even start to sympathize with a bad guy. Not only that, a guy who abandoned his own parents to go be a bad guy. So I think like that, and I don't think there's virtually any rumination on what that means on like, The fact that there is a moral good and a moral bad in this war, you know, as far as you can have in wars, that it doesn't come close to like a Malick movie. There's no examination or meditation on what this particular war means. So it was frustrating.
Not until the end, anyway. Unfortunately, I mean, I agree with you. And a little,
it takes a long time to really make a point.
It's really hard.
Jeffrey Wright makes one
totally
interesting point at the end, but the whole thing felt like we're keeping this black actor around so he can make one point at the end.
I don't disagree at all. I was watching it yesterday, and my roommate came in and asked what I was watching, and I told her, and I was like, you know, this movie's so hard to engage with, not just on its plotting, not just in its pacing, but also from the jump, it's asking you to empathize with people on the wrong side of history, and they don't know it. We know it. We're so ahead of these characters as to how this is going to play out, and not in a way that is endearing or compelling. Well,
yeah,
it's on like the fringes of you know, the Civil War. It's not the actual war fields. So it's like it feels like it's getting a little bit lost in the weeds of like these niche issues that were going on in the Civil War. And it's like you have the Tobey Maguire character who I think where the movie tries to like find some gray, it ultimately is not conclusive in a way that you don't expect or is all that interesting, because like his character, he has his Dutch father, and early on in the movie his Dutch father says to him, we are Dutch, we think like Dutch, we identify as Dutch, basically, while this is going on. And it's like you could try to examine the movie in a way that it's like you're, when you're talking about this war, you're talking about people caught between certain type of generations, and they have to choose a side, and they might choose a wrong side. And I don't think the movie really has that conversation in a really interesting way.
I don't know.
And what I was going to say is from the jump, as you said, Phil, the first thing you see is the title card. Yep. And the title card explains who the Bushwhackers are, which are essentially the Southerners who are fighting in, you know, Missouri and Kansas and outside of, you know, your main battlefield arenas of this war. And who the Jayhawkers are. The Jayhawkers are the people from the North. Really from Kansas, but whatever. And the way they describe the Union fighters and the Union sympathizers is as occupiers. I don't know if you noticed that. They said they were occupying the South. Well, that throws my antenna up a lot, because that this is supposed to be a, you know, that kind of title scroll you expect is objective, right? You expect is omniscient, word of God, whatever. And a subjective word like that, a biased word like that, really got it through me from the jump. And I don't feel like that tact was ever examined, dealt with, undermined in any way. So, you know, that I think that it's interesting, Phil. We talk a lot about movies that wouldn't get made today for various reasons. This is one of them. Yep. And I think this is a kind of movie that this movie with this tone and with this POV, I'm perfectly fine with this kind of movie not getting made.
Yeah, I don't disagree. I think that this, one of the things too that kind of, as I was watching this, I was thinking about, you know, when Ang Lee signed on to do Sense and Sensibility, it was a pretty big deal. It was a big deal because, you know, he was obviously a foreign filmmaker, but it was also a foreign filmmaker directing a Jane Austen adaptation, which felt very dissonant, right? That felt like, why is this happening? And I think that his perspective, the way he makes films, the way that he directed that film, gives that film such an interesting and beautiful vibe and feel, unlike any other Jane Austen adaptation up until that point. The same can be said for The Ice Storm. So it's interesting that you could see Ang Lee being like, I want to explore different parts of history through my
it's
lens.
It's what I love about
him. It's what I love about him, right? But it's also a match thing too, right? So like sometimes it doesn't line up, and it doesn't line up with this subject matter.
Right. Well, I mean, like, he's always taking some type of big risk with every single movie. And sometimes he takes a narrative risk. And that's what I think he's doing here, on top of the, you know, excessive detail that doesn't ultimately really serve anything in this movie in terms of its production value. But like, that's why I kind of feel like it's mostly aligned with taking Woodstock, because it's like, what if you take these two events, whether it's a war or, you know, Woodstock, things that are like, whether it's popular culture or within history, you know, things that have been dramatized a lot or things that have been scrutinized a lot, and trying to find a certain angle that you hadn't really thought of, and like, or like the angle of someone who experienced the thing but wasn't really a witness to it. And it's like, taking Woodstock, the guy sees like what, one band or something at Woodstock, and like otherwise is like not participating in the event and is more so experiencing the people who are experiencing the event. And this is like people who, finger quotes, experienced the Civil War, but were not engaged in the actual warfare, and were part of this fringe situation that was happening at the same time. And it's interesting because it's a perspective that, like, and an attempt that I do respect, of like the idea of, let's take something familiar and try to find a different angle to examine it. Like, that I respect, but like, there's a few times that it doesn't work. And it's always like this noble attempt on Ang Lee's part, which is why, one of the reasons why he's so interesting, because like, even his failures are fascinating.
Yeah. I agree with everything you said. It's an interesting thing. I mean, some of my favorite movies are movies about people who don't necessarily realize that they're on the wrong side of history while it's happening. They usually realize by the end. And that's the catharsis of it. Or, you know, in some cases, I do do feel like the, and maybe this might be why the allusions of Malick were made, because nothing is kind of answered at the end of this movie. But the thing I felt wanting, because again, I don't think this movie was particularly artful. I think it was a more of a you know, straight down the line buildings Roman, more or less. So what I wanted was Toby to either recognize that he was on the wrong side or recognize that what they're doing is so futile. And I don't think I got either one of those. And I think that's kind of what left me real cold at the end of this movie.
Just settles down, has a wife.
It all kind of worked out for him.
That, and then it's just, you know, that was
got a haircut.
You got your requisite Tobey Maguire, you know, stumbles into having sex for the first time scene. I think I've seen that like
that
six
scene
movies.
So much.
Well, I mean, you've seen it so many times. I mean, it's like
it's the like, worst in Cider House Rules, but it's the one of the worst.
Cider House Rules is the worst movie ever made. but so this is better than that.
I can name some Lasse Hallström movies that are worse. You want to see some bad Lasse Hallström movies?
Not even his worst movie.
Shipping News is definitely worse than Cider House Rules.
Shipping News will break your concept of reality.
Well,
Shipping News is one of those movies that I did an episode on Premiere Magazine where we did like a deep dive into each issue of Premiere Magazine, which will be coming out at some point. But talked about the casting of Shipping News. Like, it almost was John Travolta. It was almost Billy Bob Thornton. Like, Shipping News is a crazy, crazy development hellish movie that turns into a truly hellish movie. It's really something special.
But that being said,
I want to give a quick synopsis of Ride with the Devil for our listeners. On the fringes of the Civil War, Missouri bushwhackers engage in a guerrilla warfare with Union Jayhawkers. Bushwhackers Jake Rodow, played by Tobey Maguire, and Jack Bull Chillis, played by Skeet Ulrich, out to avenge the murder of Jack's father, are joined by George Clyde, played by Simon Baker, and his former slave, Daniel, played by Jeffrey Wright. Hiding out for the winter, Jack has a short romance with a war widow, played by Jewel, before dying, and Jake steps in to take care of her and her newborn before joining Quantrill's famous Kansas raid. Ride with the Devil opened on November 24th, 1999, against Toy Story 2, End of Days, The World Is Not Enough, and Sleepy Hollow. Huge weekend. I mean, I don't know what they thought this movie was going to do on that weekend, but as we mentioned, it made $635,000 on a $38 million budget.
Barely released.
It has 64% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics, 66% from audiences. I'm going to read a very quick chunk of Roger Ebert's 2-star review, where he says, "This film has been made by Ang Lee, the gifted Taiwan-born, Illinois-educated director." It's an odd way of putting it.
NYU, right?
I think so. So I don't know why he would say Illinois educated, but anyway, who is able to see the Civil War from the outside. The technical and acting credits are first rate. The actors do a good job of being contained by their characters, not letting modern insights peek through. Jeffrey Wright, who starred in Basquiat, is especially intriguing as the freed slave who keeps his own counsel throughout the movie without sending out signals about what he's doing. Jewel deserves praise for quite simply performing her character in a convincing and unmannered way. What a wonderful, she's an actress here, not a pop star trying out a new hobby. Ehrlich is good too, although Tobey Maguire's tone, tight, inward controlled, is beginning to wear on me after this and the Cider House Rules. It's time for him to make a dumb teenage comedy. Wow.
I guess he did.
Sort of?
Yeah. Kind of? The dumbest.
Spider-Man?
Yeah.
I was going to say Spider-Man counts.
Yep.
Watching the film, I could see that Ang Lee and his frequent collaborator, screenwriter James Sheamus, were in search of something serious. Ride with the Devil does not have the conventional rewards or payoffs, does not simplify a complex situation, doesn't punch up the action or the romance simply to entertain, but it is, sad to say, not a very entertaining movie. It's a long slog unless you're fascinated by the undercurrents. It's a film that would inspire useful discussion in history class, but for ordinary moviegoers, it is slow and forbidding. I agree pretty much with all of that. I would have been a little bit more effusive about some of those things, but
I looked real fast. So he went to Illinois undergrad at NYU film school. That makes sense. And it makes sense why Roger Ebert would highlight the Illinois part, you know, given Chicago Sun-Times.
Chicago, yes.
But where he was Spike Lee's classmate and they made film
That's school. Cool. Yeah. That's cool. I mentioned this earlier, but it's worth bringing up again just for what it's worth, because I do think that Cold Mountain is, first of all, I really like Cold Mountain for what it's worth, but I also think that that film is successful at doing a lot of the things that I think this film kind of sort of dips its toes into but doesn't really commit to, and yet is also a big sweeping romantic epic movie that's entertaining and engaging and does the things that, you know, movies are supposed to do. Watching this, I couldn't help but think about Cold Mountain and why that film is so much more successful. But it's also worth kind of tipping your hat to Ang Lee and James Shamus for trying to take this book, which I guess is relatively unadaptable in some way or another, and try to make a movie out of it. Like, it's hard for me to hate on a noble failure, I guess is really sort of what I'm getting at. But at the same time, it's just very cold and reserved. It's hard to, like, it has so few moments of levity.
It feels incredibly academic, a weird thing to call an Ang Lee movie, because, like, he's such, even, you know, making a fucking action movie, he's a humanist director, and it's like, you really have no, and it's not just that problem of, like, I don't want to care about these guys. That's not the problem, because, like, you are given, like, Jeffrey Wright's a character you can care about. It's just not really interested in them as people. No. That's where the coldness comes from. Usually when you're talking about this type of movie and you call it cold, it's like, it's an emotional reserve, but this feels more like an emotional access, which is like,
yeah. There's also just, there's a lack of detail in the characters as well. I feel like when we do get backstory, it's in this sort of weirdly vague sort of way. Now, again, that might very well have been what it was like back then. At the same time, it doesn't make for an entertaining film, unfortunately.
No, I couldn't tell you really one thing about Skeet Ulrich's character. And for half of this movie, this is a two-hander, right? So, they did feel very much stand-in. And I think that often is a problem with movies about kind of major historical events, where characters aren't characters. Characters are often just stand-ins for, you know, ideas and moments in history or positions in history. And it doesn't seem like it's that hard to do. It's a pretty big oversight to just kind of...
I agree.
You just have them be kind of ciphers, right?
Something though. There's one moment. There are a couple moments, but I want to highlight one moment that I feel like is when the movie's successful at doing the stuff that we're complaining about, which is at the end of the film, the conflict between Jonathan Rhys-Meyers and Tobey Maguire. Essentially, I mean, not to kind of yada yada over the plot, but I'll just say that they have this contentious relationship. It seems as though Jonathan Rhys-Meyers is playing essentially a version of his character from Titus, of just sort of this like insane
cool though.
Jonathan Rhys-Meyers is also pretty bad in this movie too.
Oh,
but I think he's entertaining.
He's great, and like he's so fucking pretty. Like,
he's a very attractive man.
So, he's so pretty. Like, it's just like we said this. I the more I see him, is this our second movie with him or third with him this year? But
I think it's the second.
More I see him.
No, third. B-Monkeys.
The more I see him when he's younger, a younger actor, the more I understand why people were so excited about him.
Sure.
I never really got the Jonathan Rhys-Meyers excitement, but he really has a few different modes
for sure.
And he's also beautiful, like he is,
which I think he displays
than Jared Leto.
Sure. I think there's so essentially that they have this contentious relationship, and then at the end of the film, they're confronted with him again. Tobey Maguire has his gun basically drawn. And Jonathan Rhys-Meyers silently does this sort of like head tilt look at him in this very almost like a jungle cat or something. I can't really explain it. And then kind of just turns away and leaves and heads off to what is most likely his death by going to this town that's surrounded by the Union and is most likely going to die. And to me, that exemplifies this movie, right? Which is, it doesn't really hand you anything. It doesn't give you catharsis. You're sort of like, this is compelling on a certain level. There's something here. Can't really pinpoint what it is. And the interesting part's happening off screen. So you're just like, there's, you know what I mean? Like, it's all just sort of, there is something here that didn't get unearthed, that just didn't get crystallized. But I'm sort of kind of fascinated by the film nonetheless, in a weird way. I mean, Jonathan Rhys-Meyers is a perfect example of that. I think Jeffrey Wright's another example of that. As we've mentioned, he's great in this movie. He's a great actor. Silently,
never been bad. It would be shocking if he was not good right. in anything.
It is fascinating. One piece of trivia that I love is that Jewel is convinced that Ang Lee cast her because of her teeth, because the character in the book had fucked up teeth. And she's like, I think he just cast me because my teeth are all fucked up, which I think is kind of amazing, which I think is funny. But I do just want, for a quick second, we talked about Tobey Maguire kind of quickly, but I do think it's interesting to sort of talk about this moment in his career. He does Sideris roles in this film in 1999, he does Wonder Boys in 2000. And then in 2002, obviously he's in Spider-Man, Seabiscuit shortly thereafter. And then his career is kind of, I mean, I guess he can kind of do whatever he wants from that point on. He's fucking Peter Play Parker. But it is interesting how little I care about him in this movie, considering the movies that he had done previous to it that he is quite good in. So I don't know. I don't know what to say to that.
It was kind of shocking to me because, like, I don't know if anybody has ever known how to appropriately cast Tobey Maguire like Ang Lee did in The Ice Storm. And then Correct. He goes and completely miscasts him again. Or not again, but like, because The Ice Storm is the perfect character for Tobey Maguire. Like,
it's true.
Earnest, uncomfortable, awkward, you know, doesn't have to talk that much.
Yes.
And like the bug-eyed thing about Tobey Maguire, one of our finest bug-eyed actors, Tobey Maguire.
Absolutely.
His eyes are going to pop. I was concerned about him like you're concerned about a pug. Like when a pug runs into a wall, its eye will pop out.
Yes.
His eye was like millimeters from popping out of his skull several times in this movie.
I would also say another reason that he's great in The Ice Storm is we get the voiceover, which I think goes a long way towards getting inside the head of that character. And I think that Toby doesn't exactly exude complexity. Like, I don't feel like there's... So the idea that you can get inside his head literally, I think, is helpful. But what were you going to say?
Well, I have a theory of Tobey Maguire.
Okay.
I'll throw it out for you guys. Tobey Maguire is supposed to play characters that he played in the three movies you liked, Phil, and that I like. He's supposed to be in The Ice Storm. He's supposed to be in Pleasantville. He's supposed to be in Wonder Boys. He's supposed to be playing betas. He's supposed to be playing introspective guys. He's supposed to be playing guys who can't really get a break. It's just obvious. Mm-hmm. Look at the guy. There are two data points that I want to point out. Tobey Maguire is a member of the unfortunately named Pussy Posse. That's one.
Yes, one of the founding members, I believe.
That's right. Tobey Maguire also is the villain of
Molly's Game.
And
the uncredited villain.
Tobey Maguire is in real life, as far as I can tell, based on these two data points, someone who considers himself to be the smartest person in the room, a bit of a tough guy, a bit of a ladies' man. He's also very wealthy. He probably doesn't like the idea of playing a beta male. And that's how we get movies like one of my least favorite movies of all time, Brothers, where he plays the big tough football player to Jake Gyllenhaal's wimp.
So, Mommy and Uncle Tommy have sex all the time.
So that's where you wind up in a society where people are so bought into this idea of a star who gets to dictate who he is, which is lunacy, that we get a movie like Brothers. And then America got really sick of it very fast, and he basically has a movie in 15 years.
I also think the only person he clearly has decided he will play a beta to is Leonardo DiCaprio in The Great Gatsby.
Which is like his last movie, dude.
And he's
Nick Carraway. Like, that's one thing. Like, it's like, it's one thing playing a fake television character in Pleasantville. Anyone would take Nick Carraway. That's a little different. But yes, you're right.
You understand my point.
Terribly cast he's supposed to be the funniest. The other funny thing about Toby is anybody who's that good at poker is pretty smart.
Yeah.
He never exudes intelligence on screen.
Never. Never. Yeah. His characters never seem particularly smart. They don't seem dumb, but they don't seem smart.
Well, I mean, like, I feel like the defining Tobey Maguire characteristic, it's like he kind of, his screen roles have a fraught relationship with it anyway, because like the defining Tobey Maguire characteristic to me is earnestness. And some directors know how to harness it in a good way, and some don't know how to harness it. Like Sam Raimi harnessed it perfectly. Gary Ross, I'm the first person in maybe two decades to compliment Gary Ross, but like Gary Ross does it perfectly in Pleasantville.
And Seabiscuit?
I don't think he's bad at Seabiscuit.
I mean, I don't love Seabiscuit, but sure.
Right.
That's not where the story is in Seabiscuit for me. Like I think it's okay, sure. but it's more on the Jeff Bridges side. But.
Sure. I thought you were going to say Seabiscuit himself.
And the horse, of course. I love the horse.
The horse. I mean, the titular role, obviously. Stories in those biscuits. But like Cider House Rules, it's like over earnest. And it's like it's not harnessed well. He's just this weird, scrawny dude who's just spouting greeting cards at you.
I also don't like the Sam Raimi Spider-Man, as people may know. And maybe I'm crazy and maybe I'm wrong, but I think once you watch Tom Holland play Spider-Man, you now know what a Spider-Man is supposed to be. And that Toby he did it all wrong. Like there wasn't a Spider-Man before that, a big mainstream Spider-Man. And I appreciate that they, didn't cast a muscle guy. They cast a guy who actually looks like he was in high school. And every time he delivered a little bon mot, I wanted to like carve my face up,
I think that's probably more in the Raimi side of it than it is in Tobey Maguire, though, because like I don't know how interested in like the humor of it Raimi is, or like the like trademark Spider-Man humor Raimi is all that interested in.
Right.
He wants to tell this puberty story,
which is cool. And like I know people think Spider-Man 2 is amazing. I'm not gonna knock that, but I think just to Spider-Man, to go down the spider web a little further. I think
don't
that,
you mean the Spider-Verse? We're following the Spider-Verse.
Yes, to go further into the Spider-Verse. I did mean that. Yes, you're right. We'll pretend I meant that the whole time. I love Tom Holland's characterization, and I love the way they're able to make that fucking movie funny without him being a dick all the time. Because Spider-Man has always been a bit of a dick, and I don't like dicks as superheroes. I like Tom Holland, who's so fucking funny, but so nice.
I don't know
so
what Chris genuine. Pratt you're talking about.
What? What Chris? I know.
My whole thing.
Which Chris?
I mean, I agree with Kenny. For the most part, I don't hate the Raimi movies. I don't particularly like Toby in it, but he's fine.
I also thought Andrew Garfield was a step up. So what do I know?
No, and I don't disagree with you. I mean, ultimately, I think that, you know, Spider-Man is what Spider-Man is. And I think that Tom Holland's the best casting of it. I know that that purists or comic book fans have their issues with where Spider-Man has gone, just in terms of the fact that there are a lot of people that just love their neighborhood Spider-Man, who's just like a villain.
And it got really good, and it's the best property that they
anyway,
have.
I'm not going to fight this fight. It must be a nightmare.
The people who love the Raimi Spider-Mans don't love it for Tobey Maguire. That's safe to say.
But I do think that it did tap into something, and I do think that it did give Tobey Maguire some flexibility to do roles that he felt perhaps he was always supposed to do. Yes. I guess I don't know.
Yes,
and that's an unfortunate. It's not the best. But in terms of Ride with the Devil, there were a couple of things I wanted to highlight. Mark Ruffalo pops up for one scene, which is odd, considering out of nowhere,
totally anachronistic. Like he has standard baby Mark Ruffalo haircut. He left from this and immediately starts shooting You Can Count on Me.
Yeah,
not like the right most the anachronistic side. Presence in the movie, and the movie includes Jewel. I mean, Mark Ruffalo is just such a modern actor.
It's crazy. It felt like a favor. Like, in a weird way, at this point in his career, obviously it's not, but it did feel like, he's like, will you do a day on Ride with the Devil for me, Mark? And he's like, all right, sure. And he shows up and he does, it's one setup. I don't even think they punch in for a close-up. I think it's just one setup. And he's
actually, the movie he probably came off the set of and immediately showed up to this one was 54.
Yeah, probably.
He's in 54.
Do you think he knew? Do you think he got more than just his sides, and he knew that his character was a traitor who went and killed the guy? Did he go and kill Toby's dad? Yeah, he went and killed.
I couldn't tell you that level of plot detail in this movie. Yeah. I watched it a few days ago, and it immediately vanished for like details like that.
Yeah, he's like the German in Saving Private Ryan who killed Jeremy. You know what I'm talking about? No, he didn't kill. He killed Adam. Killed Adam, the Jewish guy.
Adam Goldberg.
Yes.
Yeah. Jew is what you said.
The Jew. He killed the Jew. Well, I'm a Jew. I can say.
Yeah. I know.
But he's like that, except he was a good guy who was fighting to end slavery. So come on.
So when the credits came up at the beginning, there are names that jump out at you, right? Like people are like, I didn't know they were in this. I didn't know Tom Wilkinson and Margot Martindale. And then Mark Ruffalo, at least like 7 to 10 names deep into it. I was like, okay. You're totally right. It's completely anachronistic. You're like, why is he there? What's going on? And disappears. We never hear from him again. I also think that I want to highlight the action in this film, because I do think that it is very specifically made, if that makes sense. I think that it's messy. It feels, I mean, I obviously wasn't there. I don't know what it was like during then, but it feels very realistic. It feels kind of harrowing in a sort of random acts of violence sort of way, where it kind of comes out of nowhere. It's a very jarring action movie in that way, which I did think was a choice, and I thought it was an interesting one. For instance, there's that scene up top where they shoot everyone at that store for serving Yankees. It's a very upsetting scene where they basically go in, Toby and Skeet go in dressed as Union people and then murder everybody for serving them, essentially. There's a lot of that in this movie. There's a couple sequences that feel like that. There's a big one deeper in the film where they essentially just burn a town to the ground and kill everybody in this town. And
which was terrible, but also incredibly done. All the action sequences were amazing.
I agree. Yeah. That's when, you know, there's probably, I think, three or four of them in the film. And it's when you inevitably sit up and notice, right? Like you sit up at that point and the movie has your attention at that point. I think it knows that it does, but then it just goes so up and down where you're just like, there's swaths of this film where you're just like, what's happening? What are we doing? What's happening? I mean, but then you do have good, I mean, the whole amputation stuff is
is brutal.
Brutal. That, but they effective. Cut to that like macerated leg.
Oh. Oh,
like four times before they even cut it off.
Yeah. It is gnarly. Skeet Ulrich, Jack Bull Chillis gets shot in his arm and it just eviscerates basically his arm. And it seems as though
his arm, not his leg. That's right. No,
they refuse to. I think it's Toby that refuses to cut it off, right?
It was his arm, because I remember Jeffrey Wright said it was getting black up to his armpit.
I can't even remember the parts of his body. I have a visceral image of that bone sticking out, though.
Yes.
Yeah. You remember that? Yeah. But you know, so there's an interesting, again, like, there's this conflict that exists where they have him pinned down. They don't know what to do. They know they can't get a doctor. Toby doesn't want to cut off the arm. But they know it's going to become gangrenous quite quickly if they don't treat it in some way. They try to sort of cauterize the wound with a hot knife. That doesn't work. It becomes gangrenous. They try to chop off his arm. He dies shortly thereafter.
You just explain that like a guy who's sold a few medical pilots.
What can I say? But it's
pretty impressive.
But it's very effective. At least, I mean, viscerally, I think we all feel this way as just being humans, where like medicine and mortality conflicting with these people's emotions and their inability to be able to separate how they feel about a person from what they're dealing with medically is stuff that I find really compelling. And I thought that they did a good job, but unfortunately, that's only 5 minutes of a 2.5-hour movie, but you know,
I could have done. I mean, for real, I could have done with more gruesome shit.
I agree.
I think that old wars, particularly this war, where you had guns and bullets and bayonets and knives and all these horrible things, and we did not have modern medicine, so you were doing crazy shit like cutting people's arms off when they have some issues.
It's modern weapons
with medieval solutions, and that's a pretty interesting moment in history. Like I was always kind of taken with that in the beginning of Dances with Wolves, where the plan was to cut off his leg.
Legs. I believe it's both. Yeah,
and they were just going to get him drunk and cut off his legs. Yeah. And that really was kind of a wake up call moment for me to this is what they used to do. And that was right after the Civil War, right?
Well, you're tapping into something that I find really interesting as well, is sort of like, I don't know if you guys watched The Nick. It's not a show that I could watch all of because it was too hard for me to watch. But again, there's just this sort of antiquated medicine, antiquated ways of keeping people alive, To your point, Kenny, I do find fascinating. And there is something very sort of, I don't know what the right word is, but sort of intrinsic and scary about that stuff that I think they could have done more with here. But I'll say that the sequence, these bushwhackers overrunning this Union troops on the edge of this town and then taking over this town is probably the sort of the biggest action sequence of the film, probably, I would say. Mm-hmm. And outside of the score, which I think kind of betrays the film from time to time, because I did feel like the movie tries not to do these big high shots of lots of people riding into town. It tries to be intimate. So when there are those wide shots, the score just goes so fucking big and tries to be like, yes, you're in an epic for like a second. I think it doesn't do the film any favors. But this is one of those sequences where that happens, where they're kind of charging into this town and they just massacre everybody, children. It's an awful
sequence.
They burn
like the church and the school down to the ground.
Yeah. It's just terrible. Toby demands breakfast from some poor woman who's like, you know, working at some restaurant with her husband and kid. It is definitely the moment when he felt irredeemable to me.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds. And they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedy-ad-free. That's amazon.com/comedy-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And I would argue, I'm not sure that he ever becomes redeemable.
But then he white knights right away. Like that's it, like it's the whole thing. Like you almost get whiplash from how you're supposed to feel. Maybe look, maybe you're supposed to feel people are layered and you know, not everything is black and white. But I don't know. I don't feel like that was I don't feel like that was the story I was being told.
I mean, this is a movie that does exist in multiple versions, and that type of storytelling truncation really made me wonder, okay, how long was like the work print version of this movie? Like, is there giant chunks of like character development or like things happening that, you know, we will just never see because the movie became too unwieldy?
Yeah,
like that. I mean, that seems like the type of thing that could be missing.
It's possible. The Criterion version of this film, I believe, is 148 minutes. I don't own the Criterion version. I thought about buying it and then was like, you know what? I'm just going to watch the iTunes version. So I don't know how much different it is, but you know, maybe it's a better film.
That's the version I watched.
I did not buy it.
Support your local libraries, everyone.
you guys didn't watch the Tubi version?
I was going to say the theatrical version is on Tubi.
I went to
for our listeners.
I tubed it up.
You can watch it on Tubi. I rented it on iTunes and watched the version that I think clocked it around 2 hours and 18 minutes. That's the theatrical cut. Okay. So yeah, I mean, listen, I don't know. Maybe you're absolutely right, Chris. How did you watch the Criterion version, right? Which is so.
I can't imagine what 10 minutes were taken out of the movie. Take your pick.
Okay. So it's hard to pinpoint. You didn't feel as though there was. So I guess my bigger question is, did you see this film back in the day?
No, because this movie wasn't like the release was so small. I remember having this movie like being a 12-year-old newly ignited film obsessive. Sure. I remember this being on my radar because of the EW fall movie preview. Mm-hmm. And like the movie just never coming here. I live in Columbus, Ohio. And have since I was a kid. I think it maybe might have been at like Blockbuster, but it's not one of those movies that when it's at Blockbuster, you know, it covered a whole wall. You know, those movies, Titanic covered like three little sections of that one.
Yes.
You know? This was my first time seeing it. I can't imagine I would have chosen it if I'd seen it already.
this was a wall movie?
At Blockbuster.
No.
That's what I'm saying.
You think it even got on the wall, Kenny? Is that what you're saying?
No, I think that they probably had one copy
on the wall. Yes. It didn't cover.
Oh, is that what you were saying? Yes. In Blockbusters growing up, you basically had two kinds of new releases. You had wall movies, or they had one or two copies. I thought you said this was a wall movie. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, this was definitely not a wall movie.
Yes.
Movies for 1999 would have, like, maybe, like, the Cider House Rules would have got half a wall.
Yeah.
American Beauty got Best Picture, probably had the wall.
Got
the
a wall.
The Matrix had, like, two chunks of wall.
Half the store.
Half the store.
Half the store
was the Matrix. But, yeah, no, you're totally right. I mean, I wonder if Cider House Rules gets a wall. I feel like it does because of all that late breaking Oscar momentum it had that you guys can't talk about because it was actually nominated, but
it's crazy that
Chris, it got all- I bet that the Green Mile had a larger chunk of wall
big time
as a best picture nominee. What of those best picture nominees probably had the least amount of wall? Actually, probably The Sixth Sense had the most wall.
Without question.
The Insider had the least amount of wall, is my guess.
The Insider probably had
maybe half of a wall, two rows of a wall.
You know, The Insider, which is such a brilliant movie, is more of a mid-2000s movie. That would have really had that Michael Clayton energy behind it in the mid-2000s. But it did weirdly kind of get lost. Even though it was nominated and everyone loved it, it was a great, you know, film and a great kind of moment. It kind of got lost in the culture conversation.
Lost money. So
I think we brought it back on this podcast, right, Phil?
I think so.
We did. It was us.
I mean, it feels like that. Since we're talking Oscars 99, I am curious. Of the nominees, what do you think is the worst film of the five nominees?
Oh, God. Probably The Green Mile. I don't think it's a good Best Picture lineup.
It's not a great one.
The Insider would be my winner.
Sure.
Like, that's probably the only one that would be. I don't know what my number one of the year would be, but The Insider is probably the only one that would be anywhere close
of the five. Just to remind people, you got The Green Mile, Sixth Sense, Cider House Rules, American Beauty, The Insider. It's a weird five, especially for a year that Kenny and I have obviously continued to unpack and show how many much better films there are that deserve these nominations. But this is a roundabout way of asking you, Chris, what are your thoughts on American Beauty being the winner and being sort of the anointed, you know,
top of the mountain critically of 1999.
We've kind of talked about this or maybe danced around it or mentioned it once or twice on my podcast, mm-hmm. where it's American Beauty, aside from being the emerging Dreamhouse, DreamWorks is the distributor that gets three Best Picture wins in a row. Because they win American Beauty, Gladiator, A Beautiful Mind. American Beauty kind of benefited from, it was the ultimate thing, the peak of these 90s movies that are all about unpacking nuclear units, family life. There's a lot of movies throughout the 90s, Todd Solondz's Happiness,
as
an example, of these movies that are probably way too caustic for Academy, or Ang Lee's The Ice Storm, which is probably, a lot of people call that movie chilly. I think that's crazy, but it's probably too remote for Oscar, mm-hmm. in the way that Todd Haynes's movies are too remote for Oscar.
Sure.
But American Beauty kind of is the culmination of a decade's worth of a certain type of cinema that finally this is the one that hit in their taste, but they were also I think in a certain way acknowledging the business of DreamWorks, I mean, there are worse Best Picture winners. There are definitely more recent Best Picture winners that age even worse than that movie.
Very few that age worse, in my opinion. But there are worse movies. But it's ironic in its own way, because at the moment it did seem somewhat iconoclastic, and in retrospect,
absolutely sold that way.
Yeah, and you're totally right. It is sitting on the shoulders of probably 15 years of better, more interesting
filmmakers. Way better movies that are doing similar things.
Yes, and taking more interesting, taking more interesting avenues into this other than, the poor white cuck. But basically, I didn't mean to say cuck, but cuckold. It's amazing to me how a modern how poorly this contemporary film that seemed so forward thinking has aged, not just in content, which is a complete mess at this point, but also in style. The synth scores of the 80s, I think people thought would age very poorly. when in fact they've aged incredibly well and they're like my favorite things in the world. But the doop, 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 that I think it was who did that? And
look, it's Thomas Newman.
It's Thomas Newman.
Thomas Newman. And look, who, I like after the score for that movie.
Score for everything, yeah.
After the score of that movie, he's like, okay, so where are my American Beauty demos? Just throw that on that fucking thing.
Yes, we'll do it. Oh, like, and then everyone else is
forward
like that.
Absolutely, yes. Is like the B-sides of American Beauty.
Yes. And look, I love fucking True Romance and I love the score, but that's one moment, one score in one moment. And I think everything about this movie ages really poorly. I have a question, not to just take this topic in a slightly different direction.
Let's do it.
We often talk, Phil, about, and we're basically leading up, like kind of the culmination of this podcast is going to be us giving our nominees and winners for all of this stuff.
Love
and
it.
I presume that that's going to be our favorite movies, Phil. I wonder, you know how like there are a few years, like the year with Network, and I guess it was 76. There, what was it? Was like all the presidents.
It was all the presidents by Network and Rocky were the three that year.
There were like four out of five were like classics. There are these years that are just, or I think it was like 74 that had like Godfather 2, The Conversation, Dog Day, whatever. But you get what I'm saying. What would have been the five like super respectable movies? Not like me and you sitting around being like, man, right. I really think that like Drop Dead Gorgeous would have been a great nominee this year. Like, what are the ones that people would have looked back and been like, yes, those are the five that like really feel like the five films that we should be acknowledging?
I think that
you understand what I'm saying.
Yeah, I hear you. I think that the two that I feel are the most sort of everyone goes like they fucked up by missing these two feels to me like Talented Mr. Ripley and Magnolia are the two sort of big Oscar baity movies that in that year the Academy just went, we're good. Like that just felt like we don't need this.
I mean, Magnolia is still by the terms of the Academy. Like that's the thing about American Beauty. It was sold to the Academy as this is your transgressive movie,
right?
And aren't you so progressive for voting for this movie? But like Magnolia is still, you know, a movie that opens with this montage that has nothing to do or like with the rest of the movie. It ends in frogs raining from the sky. It's a little too weird. And like I think also like the Tom Cruise character and his monologues are way too like caustic for the Academy at the time. Like I think it's
I think that he should have won. It feels like that was his shot. I think that, you know, Michael Caine winning for Cider-Hearst Rules is laughable.
Not great.
I mean, a terrible New England
not
accent.
Our best work as a society.
I mean, a joke of a performance, but Talented Mr. Ripley feels like, and we've talked about this a little bit, we talked about it on the Cider-Hearst Rules podcast, but it does feel like Miramax was a co-pro on Talented Mr. Ripley with Paramount. They went all in on Cider-Hearst Rules since it was the one they owned in its entirety, and that's the one that fucking Weinstein did his
I think Ripley is a lock on the list I'm talking about. I think Eyes Wide Shut is a lock on the list I'm talking about. Yeah. I think you look back 23 years from now, and I do think if people saw Eyes Wide Shut on that list, it would make sense. It would feel right. You'd feel like it was the right film in that moment. The other one I would say I do feel like was not too far outside of the Academy's purview that would have felt right is The Matrix. It did win Best Editing. It is, you know, it doesn't feel quite as insane as nominating like a Mad Max, Fury Road.
I was going to say, if The Matrix had come out today, The Matrix would definitely be nominated for Best Picture.
Yeah,
well, we've definitely done when we've talked 1999 movies. Sometimes we'll talk about on my podcast, you know, if it was a year where there was a 10 Best Picture lineup, you know, not only what would be the movies in the year as it was, what would have made it through, but like what also changes the Academy's minds on what they're willing to consider when they have more slots to consider, you know, and The Matrix is the first thing that, you know, comes to mind.
The only other one that comes to mind, Kenny, and it's a, I think it's a little crazy, but I'm going to say it anyway. I do think that if Election had been nominated for Best Picture, obviously it's an MTV Films. It's got all sorts of stuff attached to it. It's got all that whatever. But I think that if Election comes out today, and I don't mean with Alexander Payne's, you know, having made all the films that he's made, but I just think that that's a film that feels like critics would rally around it. I think it could get, you know, with the right push, that's a movie that I could see perhaps getting a Best Picture nomination.
It's not so much what would have been nominated today. It's what we would have looked back and felt was kind of representative of where, you know, of
I mean, it was representative of where we were.
Some kind of alchemy between where we were at the time and looking back the way we feel about these things.
Yeah.
And the other one, I think Election's a good one. I'm searching for something in the vein of like a studio movie that is not like big and loud, like Notting Hill, which doesn't feel quite perfect to me. Like in that
made style. A lot of money.
I do think it's the best romantic comedy of that year and one of the best ever made.
I think
as good as it gets slot is kind of what I'm looking for.
No, I totally hear you. You know, what's interesting, and I think it's the reason that we keep coming back to this discussion, is that generally speaking, and I don't want to paint with too broad a brush, but generally speaking, I do think that the nominees for Best Picture, and I mean all the nominees, not the winner of Best Picture, because I think we all know that that's generally not indicative of much, but the nominees tend to be a relatively good cross-section of where we are as an industry in right. that moment. And what's weird about this year in 99 is it's not. Mm-hmm. is that...
That's the best point.
Right? Like, it just doesn't feel indicative.
Green Mile and Cider House Rules especially should not have been anywhere near the five.
Yeah, not even close. So it's one of those things where, and listen, we
Oh, by the way, Six Sense being on the five, not a bad thing, but keep going.
No, not at all. But it's just a weird, I mean, listen, I think maybe it is indicative of the fact that 99 was such a weird year in the best possible way that there was just so much that kind of came at them in weird different ways that they weren't sure how to process it all.
You know, we're missing the obvious one.
And
which one is?
Being John Malkovich, I think everyone would have felt pretty fucking good.
No, for sure.
Being John Malkovich because there was like, if they really wanted to be subversive, not American Beauty subversive, they would have been being John Malkovich. But like being John Malkovich absolutely would be in like a 10 lineup. Toy Story 2 would.
Definitely.
I think it's, you know, what's interesting too, and we've talked about this a little bit, Kenny, but you know, your primo Oscar slot is generally your Christmas Day corridor where you want to kind of be the last movie that's seen by Academy members and kind of plant your flag. And the Christmas Day movie of this Christmas year was Talented Mr. Ripley and it was Angel of Ashes. So it was like those two movies, which I'm sure you guys have done on your podcast.
Chris, have you done that?
We haven't because it's an Oscar nominee.
What did it get nominated for?
John Williams score?
Of course. Why did I even ask? So
this is another thing about 1999, why something from the summer like Sixth Sense, which is a huge hit and like, you know, probably got a deserving reassessment for these type of terms, is like a lot of the prestige movies that were actually happening at the time were either not quite to their taste, like Ripley, which like Ripley is also probably closer to a Todd Haynes movie. Or things that are like too much for them, like being John Malkovich got its nominations, but like, you know, it might have been sixth place for Best Picture, who knows. But, you know, a lot of the prestige-y things are just, like, too extreme, like Fight Club or Magnolia. So they go, like, it's so easy for Cider House Rules to be essentially the biggest competition to American Beauty because it is the sentimental movie, you know, it's the movie that makes people cry.
John Irving,
There's also, you know, Magnolia is I mean, and Paul Thomas Anderson is quite open about this, is such a love letter to Robert Altman in so many ways. And Robert Altman was never loved by the Academy. I mean, he never, I don't think he ever won, if I'm not mistaken.
He did
I don't
not.
Think he ever won.
He won
nominated
an honorary
a bunch,
award.
But never won. got an honorary award. You know, so there's something there too, right? Which is he made this film, this sort of big sweeping, you know, pretty critical to some degree or another of California and of people in the Valley. And so to your point, I think there's something to be said for the fact that and it's, you know, it's a 3 hour plus movie. I get all the reasons why Magnolia didn't hit in its moment. It doesn't make it any less painful.
They made it up a few years later.
And it didn't make money.
Yeah. They made it up a few years later when they gave it to Crash. So you got your own.
So it all worked out in the end.
You're good.
I want to just to
what
wrap
did Crash
up Ride
beat?
With the
I can't
Devil.
Remember.
Brokeback Mountain.
That's right. Let's get back into Aang.
We're gonna get back into Aang real quick, just to wrap up Ride with the Devil. The movie essentially ends with Tobey Maguire marrying Jewel because it looks like it was his baby because he dropped her off earlier in the film. So people assume that it's his kid. But even though it was Skeeter Ulrich's kid, anyway, there is a moment, and I'm sorry, I know this is so like in the fucking tall grass, but I got to highlight it because it was so bizarre to me. And I'm sure you guys probably didn't even notice it, but there's a moment in the film where Jewel and Jeffrey Wright leave Tobey Maguire with the baby to go out and do chores. And then they come back later in the day. But the way it's edited, it's like there was no passage of time. And yet the way she comes into the room and he says, you've been gone all day, but like none of the sunlight has changed. And it was just such a fucking bizarre moment that I was just like, I found it just jarring. That being said, the wedding's cute. Aang loves a wedding. So there's like the wedding is perhaps the most charming part of this entire film. If I was to like hone in on something that felt sweet and charming and endearing, then unfortunately, you know, Tobey Maguire needs to lose his virginity for the umpteenth time on film. and then they essentially, you know, they have their, we talked a little bit about the Jonathan Rhys-Meyers thing, and then they ride off to California and that's the end of the film. On this podcast, Chris, we do ratings. So from 0 to 99, 0 being the lowest, 50 being the marker of whether you'd recommend it or not, 99 being the highest. We rate it before the podcast and after the podcast as though if the podcast had changed your opinion in one way or another. So I'll go first. Coming into this podcast, I gave this film a 67. I felt like it's not a great film. I don't think it's a film that I would run around screaming and saying people should watch, but it's still an Aang Lee movie, which means it's still better than 90% of the things that get made. And, you know, it's would my number go down a little bit after this podcast? Probably. I think I'm probably in the lower 60s, maybe high 50s. But, like, I don't think this film's an abomination by any means. I just think it's kind of boring. It's not the most engaging film in the world, but I think that there's still stuff worthwhile about it, but that's just me. What do you think, Kenny?
I think it's interesting, Phil, because I think I just got to the bottom of me and you. I think you're really, really a glass half full guy, and I'm a glass half empty guy because I think we feel the exact same way about this movie. And I gave it a 41, which is like I was up a little higher for all the reasons you were. Right before the end, which was like, I you know, how cold I was left, but I was still below 50, sure. But I was like going to give it like a 47, 48 because technically it's obviously, you know, perfect. It looks great. And as you said, it's an Aang Lee movie. So, respect, but, what I wrote was, I think this was a misfire in nearly every way. The misfire from the opening title card, Occupy Northerners, not earning a lot of empathy from me, from the framing, of the way the story uses it, the framing to the way the story uses Jeffrey Wright, to the lack of propulsion, lack of character drive, lack of anything animating, some great sequences, some great action, looked the part, but ultimately a failure at an attempt to tell a big Civil War epic from the South Side, way too sympathetic. This is not a topic I want non-judgment on. So that's where I landed.
Fair, all fair. 40, fair criticisms.
41, I'm going to stay at a 40.
All right. Where are you, Chris?
I agree with everything that you both have just said. Going into the movie, I was probably like, it can't be that bad. It can't be that bad. It's got to be interesting. It's Aang Lee. When even like his worst movies, it's, you know, whatever. And like, yes, it is not all that bad, but it is never interesting. And like, I hate that, like, this is not the last Ang Lee movie that I've ever seen. Like, I feel like, because I haven't seen The Wedding Banquet, so it's like I have to go and see Ang that immediately. To like, and it's a, he does love a wedding. Famously, he even made a movie about one that had a banquet. Like, I wish, like, if anybody else is going to be an Ang Lee completist, watch this one last. I mean, like, not last, because he's still going to be making movies. Still making movies. But, like, as of now, this is the one you can watch last. So, like, going into it, I probably would have said, like, a 65. And now I'd probably be, like, a 40.
Well, that feels fair. You know, it's interesting, though, Chris, you bring up, you know, if people are going to watch Ang Lee's movies. It's so bizarre that this is in the Criterion Collection. Like, it's, you know what I mean? Like, when you look at his body of work and you're just like, I guess it was the one they could get. Is that ultimately why they do it? Or,
I mean, like, some of it, like, it used to be a certain type of, like, level of preservation and, you know, availability, things that, you know, the rights to things being a concern. Mm-hmm. So, like, I would imagine this is probably the easiest Ang Lee for them to have gotten the rights to. But, like, I do also think it is a certain level of reverence for the craft and the attention like, realistic detail that, like, Ang Lee is attempting. I certainly don't think that it's all that much narratively that it, like, necessarily belongs there. But, like, it is the, you know...
It's interesting that it's a Criterion. So we're going to do our top five. We'll start at the bottom and kind of go our way around. I'll start. My number five is Hulk. I think that Hulk is kind of a masterpiece. I think it's an insane movie. You know, I don't know if either of you have seen it. I don't think Kenny has. Have you seen it, Chris?
Yes, not for a very long time. I bet I see it soon.
Yes.
Well, other than Wedding Banquet, he's seen every Ang Lee film. I think that this film, I remember seeing Hulk in the theater. I remember being nonplussed with it and thinking, what is this? Because it came out so shortly after Spider-Man, which felt like this is what comic book movies are now. And then this movie came out and I just didn't really get it. Subsequently, I love how Ang Lee just really tried to actually visualize a comic book, like, to the point where there's moments, Kenny, and I don't know if you know this, where the camera pulls out and you're literally seeing multiple frames of a comic book as he zooms in and out of the frame. It sounds fun. It's great. I think you'd really like it. And I respect that, like, that it is a very bizarre comic book movie at a time when you couldn't do that. I think that if it came out today, I think people would probably be a lot more accepting of it because we've sort of changed the way that we see comic book movies. But that's my number five. What's your five, Kenny?
You know, as I said to you, Phil, I'm not the best.
He's got a couple blank spots in his blind
because
spots.
I have some blind spots, like all movies except six. The sixth being Ride with the Devil. So I
just not
will
make your five,
which is six right now.
Right, right.
So I'll put my fifth up there. The fifth movie I've seen of Ang Lee's, which is Taking Woodstock,
which
which I think is a fine movie. Can't believe it was directed by Ang Lee. I think there's some really interesting stuff going on there. Some progressive ideas for the time it was made. Sure. And the kind of stuff you don't often see when it comes to a movie about Woodstock or that period of time, or even hippies. So the idea that there were other kinds of hippies. I think it's a good movie. I just I also kind of remember thinking, is this the end of Ang Lee's career? Like, is this the kind of stuff he's going to be making from now on? So not necessarily the end of his career, but more like is he going to be
new chapter.
Is he going to be like a boring guy now? So and he's not clearly not, despite the fact that I haven't seen Billy Lynn, I haven't seen Gemini Man, and I probably will never see Life of Pi.
Gemini Man is not on my list, but you gotta see Gemini Man.
Gemini Man
does not work.
I
saw it in
3D
in 48 frames.
As did 3D, I.
And it is an experience.
It's an experience. Like, I would definitely recommend it above Ride with the Devil purely because, like, it is
a low bar.
Like, the thing is about that movie, it is like they went back in time and found. Yes. Into the 90s, and they pulled out a spec script from the 90s that hadn't been
touched.
This
is why you'd love it, Kenny.
Then they went and made it.
Yeah, it's for me.
2000 and whatever.
It's a Jerry Bruckheimer movie from 1998.
I know, and it's kind of fucked up I didn't see it for our draft. I just assumed it wouldn't make it. But with these, you know, these 2010 movies from the 2010s, I really had to work. Because I had all these children. So I really only had to see, I really can only see shit that, you know, I had to see. That's one. And two, I did think about just putting on Hulk yesterday just to have something maybe potentially knock out taking Woodstock.
You'd love Hulk, Kenny.
Hulk's kind of long, though.
You'd love Hulk. It's
instead,
long
I watched, what did I watch instead? Something else. Right. Obviously,
Chris, what's your
Gemini
vibe?
Man, though, like, it's entirely earnest in being the type of action movie that it is, whereas, like, if it was made today, it would feel like it's a riff or referencing, a certain era of action movie, and it's not. It is just that movie. And, there's layers to it, too, because, they de-age Will Smith so it's he insane. Looks like Will Smith from it's the insane. 90s. It's crazy. You gotta see that movie.
It's a crazy movie, Kenny. What's your number five, Chris?
My number five is actually The Ice Storm.
Wow.
I know that it is the number one for a lot of people. For me, it would be number five. We did an episode of it on my podcast. It's great for all the reasons that people say that it's great. I think to call it back to Ride with the Devil, which obviously has a lot of period detail, I think. Mm-hmm. In some ways, The Ice Storm is second to none in that way, in focusing on this really specific time during Reaganism and this transitional moment in American culture between generations, with, you know, just gender roles, sexual politics, drugs. It's a great movie.
We will talk about it later when Kenny and I, number four for me was Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, which I watched again when Blank Check did their Ang Lee miniseries, which was whenever it was because time's a flat circle now. But it was, I was just it's jaw dropping. That movie is so beautiful to look at. And what it did in terms of just opening up for some people's minds to, you know, a part of a film that comes from a part of this planet that people don't unfortunately give notice to. I think Americans, it changed American perspective of Asian cinema. It made it into ballet. It's a dance. It's just so beautiful, and the it's such a love letter to so many different types of genres. It really is a masterpiece. It's crazy to me that Gladiator beat it for Best Picture. But you know, it's what it is. But yeah, just a tremendous film. What's your four, Kenny?
I have a feeling, Phil, we might go four for four on these top four. Also, maybe. Crouching Tiger.
Okay.
I love Crouching Tiger. I can't remember actually being more excited for a movie. There's something about the trailers and the Ang Lee of it and the Asian cinema of it that really excited me at the time. It blew me away. It's kind of the kind of movie that, like you were alluding to, Phil, but just for me, expanded my horizons. Actually did have an effect on the way I view movies and view world cinema. So I love it. Great film.
What's your four, Chris?
My number four, also a movie that I have done on my podcast. It is Lust Caution. Mm. Lust Caution fucking rules. I feel like it's one of the most layered and complex of his filmography. It's like a movie you don't know how you feel about what you're watching. It's like this noir erotic thriller that's also incredibly like politically observant about World War II, in a very like specific way that we talk, like, again, talking about like this side thing happening while the bigger event is going on. That's something Ang Lee loves. And it's Tung Wei, who is the lead of the movie, is like one of my favorite performances of that decade.
Really? Okay.
She has this really complex like spy narrative where it's like the political game that she is playing is very mirrored in the sexual one that she is as well. I love that movie. I will ride hard.
You know,
for that
it's interesting because like that's the type of movie that the Criterion Collection should be doing, right? Like that's a movie that deserves to have more people noticing it, you know, to get sort of that love. It's, I mean, not to keep harping on it, but like Ride with the Devil doesn't need the love, right? Like Ride with the Devil doesn't need people to be like, oh, well, I'm going to be a completist and watch the entire Criterion Collection, so I guess I got to watch Ride with the Devil.
Yeah,
like,
it's more about making sure that that movie doesn't get completely forgotten, which it would if they didn't have
it. For sure.
I will say, like, Les Caution was the one that I was like, please put that in the Criterion. And actually, Kino has a really great Blu-ray that they just released last year. I think it's even in like a 4K restoration. It looks stunning.
So my number three is Brokeback Mountain. I struggled with these top three for me. I adore Brokeback Mountain. I think it's a masterpiece. I think it's insane. Obviously, the Crash beat it for Best Picture. I mean, makes no sense. I think it's probably certainly within the last 20 years, definitely the most egregious winner, when everyone obviously was like, how did Brokeback lose? I remember vividly, probably Entertainment Weekly, I remember reading that Ang Lee was going from Hulk to Brokeback Mountain, that his next film was going to be a adaptation of this short story about these two cowboys that fall in love. And I just remembered thinking like, okay, like that is a swing and I hope it's great, but like that felt risky. And I don't mean to say that, I don't mean that in a derogatory sense, but just like wasn't sure that was going to work. And if it didn't work, it could be a real blemish on Ang Lee's career. To go from Hulk to that and to quote unquote fail would be a brutal sort of 1-2 punch. The film comes out and obviously it's a masterpiece. I saw it I remember seeing it at the Arclight in 2005 in the theater, and you could hear a pin drop. It was just the level of how captivated people were by it. Four tremendous performances. People don't give perhaps Michelle Williams and Anne Hathaway as much credit as perhaps they deserve in terms of those supporting roles. And
Michelle Williams, they do, but Anne Hathaway was one of Anne Hathaway's first role. People hardly even acknowledge she was in it. She was fantastic.
And she's fantastic.
This is where gay people are right on the on history, because you talk to gay people and they're like, Anne fucking Hathaway in that phone call scene. incredible.
But it's a tremendous film. I adore it. And I'm sure it's on both of your lists, and we'll talk about it more when we get to your thoughts on it. But Kenny, what's your three?
So I was wrong. My three, you like Sense and Sensibility just a hair more than I do, where I didn't have a problem picking my one and two. I didn't have a problem
picking my one.
I had a problem. My order of one and two, I had a problem with. Not like you had your order with one, two, and three. Sense and Sensibility is an amazing movie. I remember seeing it in the theaters in 95 when it came out and having a little cognitive dissonance that it was directed by an Asian American finding that out, because it felt at once so British and so so lived in that period, but it's also so lush, so beautiful. Such a unique adaptation. I mean, I've seen the TV Pride and Prejudice that makes me want to tear my eyeballs out. So I'm not really here for Jane Austen as a rule, but I love it, and I think you can kind of draw a direct line from that to Little Women too. Just ways to the recent Little Women, ways to adapt a classic piece of British literature in a unusual kind of way.
Totally.
I think Edmund Thomas is obviously amazing. I love Kate Winslet too. And Hugh Grant is so fucking cool in it. So
that's great.
It's great film.
What's your three, Chris?
My number three would be Crouching Tiger, actually. It's always fascinating to me. And I realize that in different parts of the world, the movie's been received differently, but it's always fascinating to me that Ang Lee thought he had a failure on his hands with that movie. And it was an incredibly fraught production, and you would never believe it because it's the most like elegant, poetic movie you've ever fucking seen. Yeah, I mean, what can you even say about Crouching Tiger that hasn't been
said? Elegant is the word.
Elegant's a perfect way of putting it.
Yeah, like
such an elegant movie.
That is when I experience cognitive dissonance, when I watch that movie and you read about it and he thought that would end his career.
But it's interesting because I remember reading similar stuff around the time, and one of the biggest things was Wu Ping, who does all the choreography for all the action sequences, the martial arts sequences. It was Aang who was like, it needs to be like dancing. They need to literally be like they're flying. It's a ballet. And Wu Ping was like, this is not going to work. Like, this is not how we do things. Like, this is not. So I imagine that's in his head too, where he's just like, I am going against, you know, decades of this genre being done in a specific way. And of course that's the beauty of it is that he did that. But, my number two, is Sense of Sensibility. I too remember seeing it in the theater. I remember just, I am not a Jane Austen person, particularly. I'm not even really, quite frankly, a period British period piece person.
I hate the Brits. You know that.
There are some that I love and truly, truly love. But I'm not, you know, I can't go particularly deep in that genre. I think part of the reason that I love this one is what you were just saying, Kenny, that whether I was cognizant of it or not as I was watching it, it didn't feel totally British. That it was directed by this Taiwanese man who gave it just this slightly different perspective on things that just made it feel a little different. And then on top of that, you have this, you know, acerbic, brilliant script from Emma Thompson that is kind of deconstructing and fucking with Jane just a little bit in order to make it feel a little fresher and have it a little bit more of a crackle to it. And then just like the deep bench of like Hugh Laurie and you know, Amelia Staunton and like all of these people that are all, you know, just filling out the cast. It's amazing. And I will cry every time Emma Thompson and Hugh Grant get to be together at the end of that film. It's just tremendous. It's great.
Maybe I'm mature enough now to watch some British period pieces that don't have some kind of pop edge to them. I don't know. I certainly am not mature enough to watch American period pieces.
I assume I know what your two and your one is, but
my number two is Brokeback. I mean, Brokeback's a 99 for me. I saw it for the first time at Telluride. I think that your kind of preamble in terms of the perception of that movie before it came out. I mean, I would go even further. The word Brokeback was already a punchline before the film came out.
Yeah.
Gyllenhaal and Heath Ledger were already had like, basically the contracts to signal the end of their careers in their possessions when that movie came out. Like culture was not ready for this film. Truly not ready for this film. And it had to be this good. It had to be A+, A+, A+ in every way for it to go beyond the small sliver of society that was willing to even engage with this kind of movie to people who generally weren't and would only go there because of just incredible word of mouth. Mm-hmm. So I think that was one of the more amazing kind of feats ever, in terms of overcoming this really dark kind of gross, you know, like Knives Out thing for this film. Now, the film itself, I think, is just so brilliant, so beautiful, so touching. I think the two main performances, the two lead performances, are incredible. They're what's interesting about this film is, I think, I you know, look, as not a gay person, I may step in shit here, but it isn't just another romance. It doesn't feel like someone grafted a classic hetero romance onto a homosexual story and said, "Here you go." This feels like very much a story between two men falling in love in, I guess it was Montana at that period of time. And not just the way society would have viewed it, which frankly, I think is like the easy part to write. The hard part to write is the stuff between them. And that's where I think this film really like flies above almost every other film ever made. So it's only two, because I'll tell you why in a second.
What's your two, Chris?
My two would be Sense and Sensibility. I mean, you obviously can guess what my number one is going to be, but like between my number one and my number two, it's like when I call Ang Lee a humanist filmmaker, it's like, these are the two movies that I think of. Sense and Sensibility. Yeah. Like, I mean, you know, not to put it in too easy of terms, but when we think of like costume dramas, like classic literature adaptation, like, even some of the best have this emotional remove. And like, it's amazing to me what, and I think like, this is, it's the movie that a lot of other movies like it are chasing in terms of the emotional access, the emotional understanding, the way to actually bring that to the screen of people who live lives very different from us. Ang Lee just like has it in this movie, like understands the very specific emotional context that these people live in, the relationship dynamics that make it this movie where we're fucking sobbing by the end at Sense and Sensibility, which is like, you know, at the end of the day, it is a comedy, but we have this huge emotional response to it. And I think it's because he really like has an empathy for these sisters, for, and like understands not just like who they are as people, but like what it means to live their lives as they do in the time that they did.
Yeah. I think that, you know, there's a lot to be said, and there has been a lot said about the way Ang Lee actually directs his actors, the way he is a director on set. He's a very reserved person. He, you know, very few words, the way that he sort of directs. There's Hugh Grant told a great story about how the first day on set after a take, Ang Lee went up to him and said, "I don't know how to say this, but what, can you be better?" Now, I think which I think is just fantastic, because he kind of hides behind the language barrier, but also gets, there's something very interesting about the way that he approaches these films, and just the spectrum of it is tremendous. What we've talked about just in these five films or our five picks is really just pretty spectacular. My number one, and I think it's Kenny's as well, but I mean, The Ice Storm, I think, is a movie that was pretty seminal for me. It's kind of a DNA film for me in a lot of ways. I was 17 when it came out. I believe it was 97, correct, Kenny? I think
97. Yeah.
Same. So like, I'm 17 years old. I'm right around the age that Tobey Maguire's character is, and Elijah Wood's character. Like, I'm very much sort of in that mode. I read the book, the Rick Moody book as well. And I was all about Aang after Sense and Sensibility. So I was just really excited to see what he did next. And The Ice Storm obviously was his follow-up. The Criterion is a beautiful film, or beautiful, you know, transfer and everything. But that movie is just, that the score is spectacular. The look of it, I know that people talk about, it's called The Ice Storm, so I think there's a lot of projection going on too, of like, it's a chilly movie, it's a cold. I actually agree with you. I don't think it's a particularly cold film. I think it's about people struggling with their emotions and figuring out how to express themselves, but I don't think it's actually, I think it's a very open-hearted movie. The end of that film, the Elijah Wood, you know, resolution, I don't want to spoil the film for people who haven't seen it, but it's a heartbreaking, powerful, tremendous movie that I adore.
Kenny?
Yeah, me too. Ice Storm number one. Ice Storm is probably my I wouldn't say it's my favorite movie, but it's my favorite film in the genre I aspire to work in. It is like my guiding light for what I would like to do when I grow up and become a big time guy. So I love it so much. I've been actually kind of pestering my wife to watch it with me recently, because since White Lotus, I've had a lot of Ice Storm on the mind, because they're kind of working with similar themes, and they're working with similar characters. And it's this, you know, this takes place, and I thought it was the late 70s. It might be the early 80s, Phil, but it's obviously a very different time period, but you know, so little has changed. And these white comfortable characters are always kind of the same white comfortable characters. But again, to your point, Chris, and this is what makes Aang such a brilliant filmmaker, and it's why Ride with the Devil is a bad choice for him. He is so empathic towards his characters, no matter their station in life.
Yeah.
And I think that comes across with every frame of the Ice Storm. And, you know,
I agree.
I've my parents have lived for the last 20 years in the town next to New Canaan. so that is the world of that film, like, kind of lives within me too. Or more literally, I live within the world of that film. So I understand these characters really well. I believe these characters really well. I grew up with these people. I lived in those basements. I've hit around in those rooms and fucked around in those woods. Those woods with the leaves on the ground, and I've seen the ice, you know, in real life, you know, kind of envelop the trees like that. And it's a very singular thing that he gets literally perfect, and is almost impossible for me to understand because so few people were actually there. Yep. This is not Greenwich. This is not Scarsdale. This is the woods. This is like an hour and a half away from New York City, and to find that perfect little 1970s. Simulcrum is just really remarkable to me. So I do.
It's remarkable it's remarkable in so many ways. And I would also just say too that you do feel this. Forgive me, but this sort of international component that he's brought to it as well. There is an otherworldliness that he's bringing to it that makes it feel like, you know, there's just a perspective on it. I think about the score, which is a beautiful score, but also the instruments that are being used are not instruments that you would necessarily correlate with this time period. There's just a lot of sort of very interesting choices that are going on. But listen, Kenny and I can talk about the Ice Storm at nauseam, and maybe someday we will. But what's your number one, Chris?
I mean, my number one is Brokeback Mountain. It's interesting because it's a movie that I kind of like. I don't want to say had to grow up with, but like it didn't hit me on my first watch. I was freshly into college. I think I was, when did it come out? 06 or
05.
So like, it's my freshman year of college. And like, you know, I think to fully understand the weight of that movie, you have to live a little life.
Sure.
And like, you just watch it now, and it's just like every single moment. It's a movie that you watch, and it's like, you really can't take anything out. And they utilize every single moment to get so much like, not just feeling, but understanding out of all of these people. And like, I think with all of us in our like top fives that we've picked, it's one of the defining things for Ang Lee for me is like, he really develops a rich sense of context in all of his movies, or at least in his best movies, where it's like, it is not just about what you are witnessing in the story, but like the setting in which it takes place and how integral it is to understand that, to understand his characters, you know, to really like get at what, you know, makes them unique. Because somebody else would make Brokeback Mountain and like, you wouldn't understand like the four leads basically in the way that you wouldn't even understand Anna Faris in the way that you do, because like her, all of these characters are products of their environment.
Could you conceive of any other director taking this movie on?
Not in turning out the movie that it is. Certainly yeah. not.
Yeah, I don't think that I can't imagine a movie so humanist as you said. You know, that he approached this film with just such open arms and open heartedness and absolutely no judgment. I mean, it's you said it best kind of earlier, Kenny, when you were like, this is why Ride with the Devil is a problem, is that he's not approaching these characters with any judgment and they deserve to be judged to some degree. You know what I mean?
He never does. And look, it's like, it's very healthy.
Yes.
It's a very healthy. It's a very healthy approach for life. And it's also pretty like, it's a way to keep your sanity too when you're making a film sure. to not judge your characters like that.
But I think it's not the non-judgment. I mean, like, it is a problem for the movie, but like, I think the bigger problem for the movie is that it's not actually developing that level of insight into the characters mm-hmm. too. It's mm-hmm. like, you can't just have the one. Like, what makes his movie special is that it's a combination of like non-judgment and understanding of who they are, and like
totally.
He doesn't.
You're talking about Brokeback
Or Ride with the Devil. Special.
Ride with the Devil.
Yeah. I mean, Ride. It's. You're totally right. It's not that I necessarily need him to condemn it. I need to be able to condemn him. So I don't need the filmmaker to say this is bad. I just need the filmmaker to be objective. And I don't, right, and I feel right. like that this may not have been Ang Lee. It might've been James Shamus, but I do think the deck is a little weighted, in the favor of these protagonists, that these are some guys that you should, you know, feel some empathy for. And, you know, they can fucking die of gangrene as far as I'm concerned.
So, Chris, next week, I'm very curious to hear your thoughts on the film we're covering next week. It's a film that I think might have had some Oscar buzz. I don't think you guys have covered it yet on your podcast. But next week, we're covering Jacob the Liar. The Robin Williams
I mean, that movie...
What are your thoughts on Jacob the Liar, Chris?
I've seen it. Not since the first time I saw it in 1999. Can't imagine why. I don't envy you boys. I mean,
fortunately, we already recorded it.
So you're good. Like in the current moment,
yes,
you've made it.
We're post Jacob. Yeah.
I mean, okay. It was also coming off of Life is Beautiful, so the more like cynical Oscar predictions, yeah it was probably there. But like, that movie died immediately.
And he's post his Oscar win for Good Will Hunting, right? So he's just like riding high.
Yeah,
it's a
rough
cynical.
Few years for Robin and his movies. It's so sad to talk about, like, his
obviously with his passing, misfires, it makes it that much sad. Know? Yeah,
yeah. I'll
say this, though. I think I speak for Kenny. I think I speak for Kenny when I say that both of us expected it to be a worse experience than it was.
Without question. Without question.
So,
isn't it only like 90 minutes or something, too?
It's a little longer than that.
Oh, never mind.
It doesn't breeze by. But I'll just say that I was expecting something far more egregious. And I think that I had my loins girded for this one.
You were expecting Life is Beautiful.
Yes.
Which I watched for the first time like last year, and I was ready to fucking flip a table
yes.
by the end of it.
That's exactly why I think we had our guard up, because I thought it would be like really twee. Right? Yeah. Like, yeah. I thought it would be really twee about it, but it's not. Like, look, it's not a good movie, but it's not bad for the reasons I feared. It's just bad because it's bad.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Like, I have family that were Holocaust survivors. I was definitely concerned. And then I watched it and I was like, you know what? Like, this, it's not good, but it's not offensive.
Yeah.
Like, I feared a movie that was going to make me go like, how could people get behind this thing? But, you know, anyway, it's just not a good movie. But
and the irony of it, to your point, Chris, the irony of it is, I do think it's a real, I think everything about it's really cynical, right? Particularly in the wake of Life is Beautiful. I think trying to do any other like silly Holocaust stuff is like, go fuck yourself and, you know, jump off a building. But it isn't actually that. It's almost like they found the wrong script.
Yeah.
Yep. And it is a weirdly a remake of a German movie from the 70s or something.
Yeah. And it's also in the shadow of the clown who the day the clown cried.
Yes, we always live in the shadow of the day the clown.
It'll just be there one day for us to see.
It will. Yeah,
that's what I'm going to do
after I do my Mickey Mouse spec for Paramount for 2024, which I'm very excited for. I'm going to find the day the clown cried, and I'm going to do a reboot, maybe an edgy reboot. We'll see.
I think there's something to, and we talk about this on the episode, but you know, a miscalibration on Robin's part, right? Like, I think that Robin Williams, when he was on and when the material matched and he was able to calibrate himself perfectly, like, there's nobody better. There was nobody better. But if it's the material doesn't sync up with him, right, it can feel just all wrong. And you can't just prop up a camera on Robin Williams and say, do Good Morning Vietnam in a Holocaust, you know, concentration camp.
You always understand it from a career perspective too, because it makes me emotional to say, but it's like, he was our greatest empath. And so you understand these things that don't work, and they don't work not because of him.
Agreed.
But
it's a weird movie. But we had Toby Herman on to talk about it, our resident Jewish guest who comes on for all things Jewish. and she came on and we talked about it. It's coming up next week. But more than anything, Chris, thank you so much for coming on and talking about Ride with the Devil with us.
Thank you for having me. This was so much fun. I mean, I know that, and I'm sure you guys have had it before too, where it's like you have a really boring movie to talk about, and you know, but at the same time, this was a blast. Thank you guys so much for having me.
Oh, this was absolutely a blast. We hope that you'll come back in the future. Thank you so much.
Yeah, whenever you want me.
One last thing, please rate, review, and subscribe. Speaking of subscribing, check out our Patreon on all the best films of 1989, Batman, When Harry Met Sally, Fabulous Baker Boys, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, Ghostbusters 2, Field of Dreams, Major League, and many, many more. We are covering all the best films of 1989 with amazing guests like Joanna Robinson, Liz Hanna, Hunter Covington, Brian Cogman, David Iserson, and many, many more. All your favorite guests from our 1999 podcast are coming on to the 1989 Patreon. You can sign up for it at patreon.com/podcastlikeit's1989. For only $5, you get access to all of these awesome episodes. And for a few bucks more, you get video of our 1999 episodes as well. Plus, there are other very cool tiers too, where you can even be a guest on our podcast. Please check out our Reddit as well at reddit.com/podcastlikeits. We're also on Twitter at podcastlikeits1999. We're also on Instagram at podcastlikeits1999. Thank you so much to Ernie and Will for producing our episodes, Sullivan for our social media, Jan Katas for our amazing art and theme songs, and most of all, thank you all for listening.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.